celebrating success, learning from legends, and growing poppies. This is Tall Poppy Talk with Grace Lewis. Kia ora and welcome to Tall Poppy Talk. Today we have Glenda Mitchell. She is a motivational coach, a keynote speaker, and a celebrated author. Alongside her husband, they founded Mitchell News, which is professional, personal, we'll get into that later. It's really exciting, and what Glenda does is she focuses on motivational and inspirational coaching. Her work inspires individuals to pursue extraordinary achievements by discovering or reigniting their passions. She encourages others to embrace intentional living and take unconventional paths to accomplish their goals. Her recent book, which we'll be discussing today, Kicking Out the Bucket List, Living Life Full with Intention and Passion, reflects her philosophy of purposeful action and enthusiasm for life. With a knack for crafting narratives that resonate deeply with her readers, her work often delves into themes of resilience, connection, and the beauty of everyday life. Glenda, you're dedicated to inspiring others through your words. And today you're a guest on Tall Poppy Talk. So my first question is, how and where are you today?
Grace, I'm in Hervey Bay in Australia, which is kind of just north of Brisbane. I'm near the beach and I'm well.
Lovely. And you're well? Excellent.
I'm well.
And so for you, it is 9 a.m., right? It's a fresh morning in December. How's your morning look like? Are you an early riser? You sleep in? I'm just curious of what a motivational coach does in the morning.
I'm normally an early riser now. Queensland is the one of the states in Australia that does not have daylight saving. So the sun comes up incredibly early this time of the year. So the birds kind of wake me up around 4. So by 5, if I'm going for a run, I'm usually out for a run because otherwise it's kind of too hot. Today was a slow one because it was pouring with rain. So it was a good excuse to kind of just rest in bed, and my husband brought me tea in bed. Then I got ready for this. So yeah, it was probably an atypical morning. So my typical mornings would probably be get up and go for a run and do as much early before it gets too hot.
From South Africa originally, right? How long have you lived in Australia?
I moved to Australia in 1995, so almost 30 years. So originally in Sydney. Spent most of my time in Australia in Sydney.
Awesome. I can imagine it's a beautiful place to write, which is kind of what we'll delve right into for my first question for you today, because you're novel, which I have, I should have put it here so I could refer to it, but it's in my room, Kicking Out the Bucket List. This focuses on, yes, thank you, living with intention. A bit of a broad question, but I think it's going to help give perspective to who you are. What motivated you to write the book and explore this theme?
Gee, I've got to do this in a short answer that kind of makes sense. So I guess it got more complicated as I wrote the book, to be honest. But the original intention behind the intention was I so often spoke to people about the things that I'd done. I tended to be one of those people that did lots of stuff. And so often when I spoke to people, they would say, but I want to do it. I'm going to put it on my list. And I thought, good, I'm inspiring them to do things. And sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. So I got a little bit frustrated because I thought, you know, if an intention is something, an idea that you plan to do, where so many people have intentions, that's an idea that they never even get towards planning to do, let alone actually doing. So at that stage, it was, for me, it was just do it. Hence the title of the book was Kicking Out the Bucket List. So don't keep listing stuff, just get on with it. So the intention part was intention about doing things. But as I wrote the book and I started thinking back on my life, and particularly because I'd gone through a health scare, I also started thinking about being intentional about what it is that you decide to do. So it's no use just getting on and doing it because somebody else is doing it or because I must just get on and action stuff. So I look back on my life and I celebrated a lot of the stuff that I'd done, which was cool. But I also realized that I probably did some of those things, not necessarily for the right reasons at the time. They weren't necessarily of value to me. It was because other people were doing them. You know, now we talk FOMO. At the time, it was probably less FOMO. But it was just, I did them because I wanted affirmation from other people. I did them because I could. I was always competitive. So if somebody else did it, I must do it. So the other intentionality was to get people to be intentional about what they actually choose to do. That hence the sort of passion part, that they intentional, that they choose things that are going to contribute to their passions to what's of value to them and to those that are important to them, not just everybody in society that's kind of around them.
Thank you. I like that. And I think we can all relate to this of doing things potentially because other people have done it or because we think other people will think it's cool or seek approval or whatever motivates you in that way. And the fact that you said intention, I intend to do something, that's actually quite a powerful word when you think about it. Like, I intend to do something that's going to happen instead of I would like to, or I daydream about this, or I think about that. No, intent holds a lot of action. It's weight. It's a weighted word. And please, yeah, I can see you thinking something. Go ahead.
I love what you just said. It's a weighted word, whereas I think we've lost a little bit of that weighting in the word. So we've started using the word intentional because somehow that's putting the weight in it, because the intention, the word intention has almost lost some of, it feels as if it's lost a little bit of its weight. So intention is just a pipe dream, a something I've thought about, it's on my list of things. Whereas intentional feels more action oriented. So it's almost like we felt the need to add L onto the end to convert it. So, because what I try, what I say to, one of the things I say when I'm coaching is I help people turn intention into action.
Oh.
Yeah. So it is interesting you say it's a weighted word, because I'd almost say, is it or isn't it? Yes, I agree with you, but maybe we've lost a little bit of that weighting in it.
In everyday conversation, some of my regular converse people will say, I'm talking, and I'll go, in the true sense of the word, that was inappropriate, or the true sense of the word, that was interesting. And I'll say this because I'm trying to get people to go back to the true sense of what the word interesting means, is that really piques my interest. That is so interesting. I want to know more. Whereas sometimes we overuse these words, or if you say in the true sense of the word, that's inappropriate, just means this is not the time or the place or the person to be saying that comment to, you know. And I feel the need to go, in the true sense, I have intention, because to your point, we've overused these words, and in doing so have diminished the value of them.
I love that. I'm going to steal that from you. I'm going to use that. Is that being trademarked? Can I use that?
Not yet. Please,
well,
feel free.
I think that's, there's so many words that, you know, we see on LinkedIn and we see all the time that have the potential to be overused. And that's when they actually often end up subject to debate, or people start debating, is it positive or is it negative? One of them being humility. And that might actually come out when we're talking about celebrating success. Because I've seen a few things lately where some people are saying humility is positive and some are saying it's negative. And really, it's probably neither. It comes back to, using your phrase, the true sense of the word.
Speaking of definitions, right into my second question, another word you use there is passion. So could you please describe or define, in your understanding, what passion is?
I was very intentional about my use of the word passion. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Passion was not just the sort of how we often see it now, is that sort of emotion. I do believe that there is emotion in passion, but I'm using it kind of in its broader sense of the word, where it's what we plan to do and how we feel about it. So it's a very intentionally, G-Beg, there it goes again, didn't use purpose, because it's more than purpose. It's that feeling that it ignites in people. So for me, the passion is core to what drives us, what actually makes us make the choices that we make. So it's I've got a model that I use, and passion sits right at the core. And when I'm working with clients, and I'm describing that only because that's how I it'll give the clear definition, I guess, of passion. It's everything from your values to your strengths, to what ignites you, to the things in the world you want to change. It's all of that kind of stuff, all gets embraced in that passion. So if you can get your passion there, I call it right, because I think it's something that evolves and morphs and that over different seasons and over your life. I think, but if you can get it right at this point in time, it's so freeing, really, because it enables you to make decisions against something that's real, but it hasn't lost feeling. It's not, it's not just a plan on a piece of paper, because passion, and that's, I guess, why I wanted to get away from purpose, because it encompasses purpose and mission and all of that, but it's how you feel about it. So it's getting to the guts of the pits of how people feel about what they see as important rather than just what on paper seems to be important.
I also think too with that, thank you, is purpose feels very like out, like it's driven from your internal, but this is my purpose, this is what I'm going to do, and that feels like an action, whereas the passion feels, if I'm trying to give it a metaphor, that feels like a fire inside of you that keeps going and ignites you, and then the purpose is what can come from that. That's that point you said there where you lead intention into action, and that in middle point is where the passion sits, and that's what fires you and keeps you going. But people, what has been interesting, I'm only early into the book, is this idea of passion, you do feel like you can lose it, right? Or people might say, I've lost my spark, or I've lost my something and I want to get it back. How do you reconnect with a passion or a sense of passion, do you think, when you have lost touch with it?
I'm going to sound like I'm making excuses now. I think the how is very individual, and I think there's going to be so many different components, and there's lots of techniques that different people apply depending on their spiritual framework, on their frame of reference, on their culture. I think there's so many things that are involved in that. So I think sort of a how, because what I hear when you say the how is people tend to want a step-by-step guide. And even in my book, I stayed away. I was going to say intentionally stayed away, and then I realized I'm using intention way too much. I stayed away from telling people, do this, then this, then this, then this. It was very much more about getting people to think for themselves and work through things, okay, things for themselves rather than a process for themselves. So I think it's going to be hard for me to say and define a process. But one of the things that I have found incredibly useful for people is reflection on the past, and I'm going to say successes, achievements, things that have happened in the past. Because what I've realized is we've become so, we must focus on the present and we mustn't get constrained by our past and all of that, that sometimes we actually, and yes, we mustn't live in the past either, and even on our successes, but sometimes we don't embrace the successes of our past. And I think there's so much about what we have done that we can use, and I'm going to use the horrible terms, good and bad, but whatever our experiences are, to actually help us define our future. One of the steps to reconnect with the passion is really to look at what's actually made you who you are and brought you to the place. And it's one of the things that I really did through the book, and I encourage people to do. And it's what I do as soon as I do coaching or group sessions, is get people to look back. And it was interesting, actually, one of the pre-readers of my book, and I'm actually going to quote, I'm going to read the quote, because otherwise I might get it wrong. He says, I learned that what I have achieved or experienced came from seizing the moment rather than have a lifelong plan and goal. So that was useful. But I learned that reflection on the past can uncover patterns and priorities in a more enjoyable way than trying to plan for the future where there is finite time. And I think that's for me, if you can look at what brought out the fire in the past or what didn't. I use the river of life sometimes as an analogy. You know, what were some of the rocks in your river? What were some of the things where there were fish and lovely things that you can actually take to reconnect with what kind of was important for you? And work out what your real drivers are before getting on to just trying to, because I think it's hard just to create an emotion, which sometimes is what we try and do with passion. We try and create emotion, and today we feel really good and we talk ourselves into it, and then tomorrow we don't. And then suddenly I've lost my passion, and then I have to reconnect with my passion every day. But if we can get to the bottom of what worked in the past and then work out what ignites us for today, we can work out what our sort of convictions are.
This is making my head run in so many different ways. The first, and then I'll get into the second. The first part was, so I'm back in New Zealand at the moment, and I started rowing in Cambridge at Lake Karapiro. And then I went to the States and I did all that. And by the time I was done with college, I was done with rowing. I was like, I'm over that. Let's put that oar away. And once a year, I get to row with my friends at the Head of the Charles in Boston. And then I rowed the other day with my doubles partner back here. And all that love and passion was just there. I was like, this is the best. I see why I loved it. Because I'd been so distracted and maybe strayed away from the passion. Because when I was in the States for rowing, it became about numbers and metrics. And are you succeeding? And are you doing this? And the thing that had been my passion suddenly became my job. And all that fun stuff, the value started to change. And so I don't know where that I'm going with that, but I'm curious your thoughts on hearing it. Is like the passion had gone away, and now that I've had some distance, it's returned.
Yeah,
I'm no longer using it as a vessel to live.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess there's two points, and I don't know if that both related to passion, but there's two points that I like from there. One is the reconnecting with people, because I would say that's one of the other things to do in terms of igniting your passion is to surround yourself by other people that have got their passion, that you can share your passions with, that can pull you up when you're not quite there. So I guess you were talking about those people. So that probably ignited some of that back. The other is, I always have this response when people say, if you do what you love as your career, then you won't work a day in your life. And I always have this skewed response, and I'm not convinced about that one yet. And it works for some people, I get it. But what you've just said, sometimes when we turn what we absolutely love into our work, we can lose some of that passion. Still grappling with. I haven't decided what the best way to manage that is. So some of the things that I've done in my life is, I've gone and done, I did a real estate license, I did my personal training certification, I did a color and design diploma. I didn't just do courses, I did a lot of other things. At the time, thinking I was going to change careers, but it was the way of doing those things, but then I kept coming back to kind of what I did. So that was kind of the way I dealt with it, but I don't quite know what the answer is. I'll be interested to see where you go from that, actually, Grace. I'll be watching.
Yes, and I like there that you say you are grappling with it, because someone in your position, it's very easy to think, well, Glenda's got to she's got to know. No, you are grappling with it because these are ongoing experiences. And the other thing I was going to say, in addition to the passion I'd felt with the rowing, is sometimes too, when you have a passion and a goal in mind, because you do reflect back, but you also reflect or think forward, okay, what do I want to achieve? What do I need to do to get there? In my experience, I used to say a lot, I don't need to be motivated, I need to be disciplined. I don't necessarily feel like waking up at 5 a.m. to go for a row, but I have to be disciplined and do that because I have this goal. Yep. So in your line of work, how do you balance this? I've got to take care of the passion, but I've also got to have discipline, because you're not always going to feel passionate every single day, but you have this vision. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, million-dollar question. I think my thoughts on that probably change every day, and don't tell my clients that. I think there is discipline. I think there is a place for that, because I think lack of discipline eventually ends up killing our passion. Because if your aspiration is to be an Olympic rower, if you don't do that discipline, you'll never achieve that. And then you won't be passionate about anything. And potentially you'll lose passion for any or motivation for anything that you're doing. So I agree with you. I think there is a balance. But I think maybe at different times of our lives, we tend towards one or the other. Maybe it's not always getting, sometimes in life we try and get everything so balanced, and we think all of our lives need to be perfectly balanced at all times to be successful. And so when I work with my clients, I actually have an integrated life portfolio model that I use with them. And it's using all the different key life areas. So it's everything from health to spiritual, to work, to family, to relationships, all of that kind of stuff. To look at what their current situation is, and we sort of do what you spend your time, your money, your energy on, and then what do you want it to be? And what I find a lot of people look for with what you want it to be is the perfect model. And unfortunately, the perfect model tends to be one that probably requires more than 168 hours a week, and we don't tend to have it. So what people then do is they realize that there is an aspirational model and there's a place for that and it's awesome. But there might be a model for, I've got a client now who's actually doing a model for the next couple of weeks because things are going to be different. And so at different stages of your life, you can actually have different states of balance. And what I've found is by people doing that, it gives them permission to not always have to look for that perfect desired model that they can never achieve. They give up and then sometimes they actually get paralyzed because they can't move forward at all. Yeah, that $1 million question. I'm sure if you could get an answer to that, you'd make a lot of money.
Well, thank you. And I think it's quite a coincidence or whatever it may be that we're having this conversation, because even in the past few days when we've been emailing back and forth, I'm like, sorry, I've been a bit MIA because I don't have balance. I'm completely focused on family, which is awesome. And to your point, it's the balance is not there. But then today has been a fully dedicated morning day of now working on my work or my podcast. And then this afternoon's family again. It's like, you cannot, at least I've found, I'm no good when I'm trying to balance it all at the same time, because that tends to just under deliver on everything. I'm better at going, here's a block of time for this. And then also the power of saying, I'm sorry. So for you, I go, I'm so sorry. I've been MIA. And people are a lot more receptive to that when you acknowledge, look, I know, not drop the ball. I know I've not been super on top of it. I recognize that. I'm sorry. Let's move on. I found there's surprisingly a lot of positive responses when you just own it like that and say, I'm not on top of it. Let's move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a whole other topic, owning things versus blaming someone else or whatever. But that's a topic for another day. But yes, I think people do, as long as you don't do it all the time. And so I do think that this sort of balance thing has put a lot of pressure on people. I hate the term work-life balance. And that's why I talk about sort of integrated life or a life portfolio, because we take one component out of our lives called work, and then somehow we try and balance that with life. But work is part of life. So what are we actually trying to balance with what? And so it's only as people start digging down into thinking, what are those components, that they start realizing what it is that they're trying to balance or integrate or whatever. I had one client who, she had an aspirational model. And then during the process, she actually realized that what she was doing right now in the season and the, let's call it balance, the prioritization, because I use a pie chart and sort of put percentages. So I do put some, here's some facts around it. She realized that that is the season she's in and that's okay. And she could have another one later on and that would also be okay. So, you know, you could literally be doing one for yesterday and one for today, one focus on family and one focus on. And that's why sometimes it's just a case of looking at the overall and saying, well, actually, I am using my time, energy, whatever, in the right place. If I look at, and you can use it a week, a month, season, 3 months, whatever works for you in terms of your time frame. Now, people, somebody said to me the other day, where do you want to be? Where do you want your business to be in 5 years' time? I just struggle with 5-year time frames. For me, it's too long. Whereas other people have to. So you've got to do kind of what works for you in terms of your timing, your balance, your integration, your components of life, what's important to you. And I guess that's what it comes back to, that passion, what's important to you and what's important to the people that you value.
You've segued right into my next question, thank you, which is, and I know we've spoken about this before, but for getting it on record, this topic of tall poppy syndrome. And what you said there was what matters to you and what matters to those people that you care about, because I'm quite an ambassador of the idea that while you shouldn't care what everyone thinks, you should care what some people think. And it comes down to who those some people are. And sometimes we give the wrong people value in terms of their care. But there are definitely people who I believe if they have an opinion of something, or if I want and I care about their thoughts, absolutely. But it's the wider world who sometimes has the most loudest opinions that we do not care for. But when regarding tall poppy syndrome, without leading the question at all, could you please describe it in your own words, no right or wrong answer, and then secondly, how you've experienced it?
So I guess tall poppy syndrome to me, in a broadest terms is where somebody actually has been successful at something or has achieved something, and somebody or a group of people either finds them boastful when they talk about it, or kind of worst case, pulls them down, sometimes to make themselves look better, or sometimes just to kind of pull them down. And it was actually really, really interesting because when I was doing the research for the session, I read that it was a social phenomenon, according to AI, according to, this is my online sources, so just bear that in mind, this is just some searches, that it actually said that it was a phenomenon that started in New Zealand and Australia in the 1980s. And I found that really interesting because I came to Australia in the 1990s. And I had never experienced tall poppy syndrome before. And I didn't know whether it was me. I didn't know whether it was Australia. I didn't know what it was. And it was actually quite nice to read that and realize, hang on, it wasn't that I was stuck my head in the sand previously. It was actually something new that I had to deal with when I got to Australia. It was kind of cool to find out. So thank you. But what I also read, which I thought was good, and I kind of knew, and I thought was quite commendable, is it really, I think, came about because people intended to have modesty. People intended to be equal. They wanted to promote equality. They didn't want to promote that somebody was better than somebody else. So I think the sources of tall poppy were actually quite commendable. But somehow it's at times turned into, instead of altogether finding ways that we can grow lots of fields of poppies, it's kind of an easier option to maybe pull someone down. And a dumb example that I will never forget is after having run a number of marathons, I was at my hairdresser, and he said to me, "Now, you know, you run marathons, not that many people in the population do marathons. I think it's 1% of runners every year do a marathon, something like that." And he said, "Why do you run marathons if you can't win them?" And how do you think that meant? How would you feel if someone said that to me? That's like, he probably was genuine. No, but my thing of feeling really good that I ran marathons, suddenly I felt really bad. That seems a bit pointless. And it was just one of those kind of examples. That, and the fact that it stayed with me just shows that all of these little things have an effect on people. So yeah,
absolutely.
And then obviously in the workplace, there's different things. As a woman with a strange accent, there's always been opportunities for people. And sometimes it's having fun, sometimes it's sarcasm, sometimes it's tall poppy, and sometimes it's just having to navigate which one it is, or it could be a combination of all of the above.
It's so interesting you say that in this timing, because as I had mentioned before we started recording, I have my American family is visiting, and there was a couple interactions where they said, "Grace, are they being serious?" And I'm like, no, they're joking. But the humor in New Zealand, and I can imagine Australia, it is very borderline full roasting someone and then having a joke, and then to your point, navigating, was that serious? Or I don't know them like that. Why'd they say it like that? And, oh, I think that was tall poppy. I think that was real. Mm. It's all that brain power that you're having to spend thinking about that. And even because I haven't been living in New Zealand as long, I'm a bit rusty on it. So there's a couple times where people go, "I'm joking." And I'm like, okay, I didn't get that. And so it is a cultural experience, 100%. And to your point about how it's commendable, where tall poppy has originated from, of these ideas of being humble and all the good stuff, it's just as with everything, the state of mind that you're in when you hear something, or who says it and how they say it, and that intention of how they say it, to bring that word into the conversation, it's the intention of why someone's saying it. So I'm curious, with that hairdresser, was it a genuine question? Were they trying to have a go? You don't know, but regardless, it stuck with you.
It does. And it took away the feeling that I had of it's something that I could do, because it wasn't meant to be a competition. I wasn't trying to say I was better than him in, because the reality is we can't all be better than everybody else. If we have to allow ourselves to be good at things, and we also have to allow others to be good at things. And I don't know, you hear some of the things with school, with the children, and everybody gets a prize. Are we breeding that into people? I don't know. But somewhere we've got to accept that I'm really good at this, but I'm not really good at that. And you know what? That's okay. I don't have to be mediocre at everything. I can actually, because I think that's unfortunately the risk that we run, is that everybody ends up potentially mediocre little puppies. We may have puppies, but they all just mediocre low ones because nobody can actually grow taller. And that is for me is the sad outcome, because I don't do mediocrity. So we end up killing off high achievers. I mean, I worked in an environment where there were a number of high achievers and they were all struggling with some of the same thing, where they were getting pulled down. If somebody could find something to pull them down on, they would. And I think because often high achievers are ultra sensitive to it, it just really knocked them.
And as equally as we weight the negative comments, I would love it. We're not quite there yet, remembering and giving those positive comments, because there are particular instances or people who have said something and they might not even remember it, but genuinely celebrating the success of another person. And it just warms your heart, lights your fire, gives you that passion because you feel seen and celebrated and encouraged. And so just as equally as that negative comment can stay with you, that positive one can as well. And that's where you've been writing about it recently. I'm talking about it all the time, is celebrating the success of the other people, not because you want anything from it, not because you, just because you want to say, hey, I see you and I celebrate you. That's awesome.
Yeah. And if you think about it mathematically, if I celebrate your success and you celebrate someone else's success and somebody else celebrates my success, we all get celebrated and we don't have to boast anymore. So we can actually put the boasting, bragging, all of that stuff off the table. But if nobody celebrates anybody else's success, we're going to struggle, because we're constantly wanting to try and tell everybody, because we all need some sort of affirmation. We're going to constantly be needing to tell someone. Then we feel like boasting, so we can't. And so we kind of get caught up in this whole cycle of not getting affirmation, because it's, and then, or we go into a false modesty. And unfortunately, we do see a little bit of that on social media. This is not quite bragging, but it is, but I've got to put it out there, because if I don't, no one's going to see what I've been successful at. But I can't actually say I've been successful. And if true success. And it's actually interesting, because even with my book, I knew it was a risk, because different people will respond in different ways. I was getting people to think about themselves. It wasn't to tell people what I'd done. It was to use what I'd done to inspire people. But I know there will be people, and there have been people, that will look at it and just as, oh, that's amazing stuff that you've done and I've done, or I've done more, or I've done better, or whatever. So there's a fine line between the whole tall poppy and unhealthy or healthy competition. Because again, healthy competition drives success. Healthy competition drives excellence. Unhealthy competition drives mediocrity and apathy and people feeling bad about themselves. So, but if we can all go into that celebration of other people's success, then surely it's a win-win for all of us.
That's awesome. I'm just going to leave that topic packaged right there, because I can't beat it. And I'll move to my final serious question before a sign-off question, is going back to this core motivational coaching that you do. There are a lot of people listening who maybe won't feel like reading a book or don't have access to you. But for anyone listening right now who feels a little stuck in life or in their current path, and they're like, oh, I wanted to do this, but I'm already on this path, what is some advice you can give? And I know this is super blanket, and your first thing is probably going to say, well, it depends on each person. But if we are to caveat that, what is some advice you can give to anyone listening who thinks, I'm a bit stuck on my current path?
I guess my first response is, if someone has already recognized they're stuck on their current path, then they're actually already on the move. So that's actually good. I'm almost worried about those that haven't yet realized that they've stuck. So for those that are stuck, I think it's a bit like that when we were talking about the passion, actually finding something to create, I guess, your own disruption. And again, disruption, we were talking earlier about the original meaning of words, and I think disruption is one of those that has negative and positive. But I say to people, try and create your own disruption. Because I had a medical emergency that 1 in 4 would have died from. And it created disruption for me. And there's part of me that thinks, well, maybe I would have been better to create my own disruption. Maybe it was a good thing. Maybe I needed that to happen. But if somebody can actually create their own disruption and find something to actually get themselves to change gear entirely. But I know that can be hard to do. So otherwise, I'd go back to what I was saying about reconnecting with passion. Go back to your life and see what it is that has motivated you, has ignited you in the past, and use that to not so much create a disruption, but to get that that ember kind of flaring again. And I think the other one is what you said, is find some people around you to help you. So find those people, because what we can do often when we're stuck is surround ourselves by other people that are stuck, because we can relate to each other and we whinge together and we get into catastrophizing and calamities and woe is me and it's all and then I can't. And so find other people that are getting out of stuckness or have got out of stuckness or are motivational, and use them to help pull us out. You know, if you're in a quagmire, it's no use pulling someone into the quagmire with you. So we've got to find people that have the ropes to kind of pull us out. So I think other people can be a huge help.
I absolutely love that response. Thank you. The disruption. I already know a few listeners in mind who are probably nodding their head going, the world had a disruption and plan for me because I wasn't ready to make my own. So that is just awesome. Glenda, before my sign-off question, is there anything I haven't asked you during this interview that you think I should have?
That's the $1 million question. Probably not. Actually, it was amazing when you sort of hit all the questions, all the stuff that I am actually, I'm going to use my word again, passionate, not the intentional one, passionate about. The one thing I just wanted to pick up, Grace, though, is when you said people don't want to read the book or don't have access to me. One of the things that I do try and do is make myself as accessible as possible. So if anybody wants, you know, it's sort of no cost, I'll do I do sort of a great conversation with people, because I just think it's really important. I think it's really important that we all, because what I do, if I don't get something from it, they can pass it on to someone else and we all benefit. So, yeah, so I'd like to say that I'm accessible. Obviously, realistically, I'm going to always be accessible to people, but I'd like to say that I try and make myself as accessible as possible for people to reach out.
Yes, I can attest to your accessibility and responsiveness, and even just the content you have on Mitchell News or on your own LinkedIn. There's so much to go through that much like this conversation can spark inspiration or passion or whatever. But my sign-off question for you, please, is very off topic from what we've been discussing. However, if you could only listen to one musical artist for the rest of your life, who's it going
to
be?
Goodness. I'm going to have a really long answer to this question. I grew up in South Africa under apartheid, and we weren't allowed access to artists in the world. They weren't allowed to come visit. We couldn't listen to online music like when Diana and Charles got married in Westminster Abbey. So I feel a bit like I've kind of been deprived of hot musical artists. Yeah. So I really have not been attached to one particular artist, and I genuinely say that. So I honestly have no idea how to answer that question. I'm really going to have to think about it, because I really, really have no idea. Sorry.
That is probably the best. No, don't be sorry. That's like one of the coolest answers I think you can have to that question, because it's very interesting and historical, and I wasn't expecting that at all. So thank you. Hard to wrap up this conversation, because I feel like we just dipped in and now we're dipping out, but that is the fun beauty of these conversations we have, and it's the first of many. Well, it's actually like the third of many that you and I are going to have. So I will formally say thank you, Glenda, for being on Tall Poppy Talk and sparing your time and energy for me and my listeners.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been awesome. One day I'll have to meet you in person, but I feel like I know you so well already. So thank you for the opportunity. It's been wonderful, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to Tall Poppy Talk. We'll see you next time. Feel free to check us out on socials, YouTube, and the website. Thanks for today's guest.